Today I'm going to start off our education unit, and we'll start out with a discussion of some of the trends going on in education. The first trend is that education has been and will continue to be a growing part of our economy. One of the books on the list of choices to read for the book project was The Escape from Hunger and Premature Death by Robert Fogel, an economic historian. And I want to start out with a quote from Fogel. Fogel says, "I believe that one of the solutions will be lifelong education. Education not to train for an occupation, but to provide a better understanding for ourselves and our world. Entirely new educational forms are needed that aim at satisfying not only curiosity, but also a longing for spiritual insights that enhance the meaning of life and that combine entertainment with edification and sociality. As per capita incomes rise and the costs of necessities and consumer durables continue to plunge, individuals and households will spend ever larger shares of their income on services that improve health, enhance knowledge, and are spiritually uplifting." I see one of the themes that Fogel has is that the basic goods, including even consumer durables like television sets and so on, are approaching a sort of satiation point. That is, maybe one example would just be food. We've reached the point where there is plenty of food. We don't have a crisis producing enough food. Maybe food isn't distributed as well as it could be. There are certainly poor people, especially in other countries, who have difficulty obtaining food. But overall, the food production problem in the world looks a lot more solved today than it would have 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And what he's saying is we're headed in that same direction with manufactured goods, that the problem of how to produce enough manufactured goods is close to being solved. And with the with sufficient food, with sufficient goods, then what are we going to turn to? We're going to turn to more leisure, more health care, and this what he calls lifelong education. Again, this is not so much education as a necessity, as a practical necessity, but as a way of learning more about ourselves, of what the psychologists call self-actualization, and even sort of education to, as he said, puts it, enhanced spiritual insights. So, for those reasons, practical reasons aside, Fogel sees education as one of the three rapid growing sectors of the economy. In addition to what Fogel says, there still are the practical reasons why you'll see more education, and particularly more education for people who are beyond the ages where traditionally there's been education. And that is the increased complexity of the world and the rapid pace of technological change. There's just no way that an education that you receive in 2004 can prepare you completely for the technological world that you're going to face in 2024 or 2034. So people are bound to need more education as they get older, just for practical reasons, apart from the reasons that Fogel is focused on. So as I said, Fogel believes that education will be one of the three main growth industries going forward. One of the other growth industries will be leisure-related services, just that we will have more leisure time. Both time in our prime working years, we'll be spending less of that time working, and then having longer retirements. And also, another growth industry will be healthcare, because people have more to spend on healthcare, and they're living longer, and the healthcare industry is providing more and more treatments, more and more useful services. So healthcare, leisure-related services, and education are the industries that he sees as growing the most over the next 50 years or so. Meanwhile, things like manufacturing, the production of consumer goods, that will take less and less of our a smaller share of our labor force and of our overall economy. Okay, another trend or related to that trend in education is that demand is growing faster than productivity. Okay, so remember when I was talking about manufacturing and why the share of manufacturing in the economy is going down, that's fundamentally because productivity is growing faster than demand. In education, we have the opposite. We have demand growing faster than productivity. So that means that it takes more and more labor to work in the education industry, and costs are rising. Another trend in education is the rapid growth in non-traditional educational forms. These include things like corporate training, is now a large component of education. There's growth in elder hostels, which would be something that Fogel would expect. That is, opportunities for elderly people to take courses. In fact, in general, on college campuses, you're seeing a lot more people on college campuses who are not traditional college age. Another trend in non-traditional education form that's growing is homeschooling. Finally, we see things like distance learning, so people learning without going to typical campuses. And distance learning may be particularly important in other countries where they want access to the education information that's available in the United States. They've always wanted that, and traditionally a lot of people have traveled to the United States for education. But now with the internet, there are more opportunities for people to learn in other countries to take advantage of American education without having to travel here and pay the high cost of living here. Okay, the next topic I want to discuss is what I call the economics of education. And what I'm really talking about is issues in education that are difficult, things that economists have trouble either measuring or analyzing. The first example is what we call value added. That is, how much value does education add? For example, you probably know that the gap between the average income of college-educated people and people without a college education, that gap in income has been increasing, and that I think it's well over 50%, that the average earnings of college-educated people are over 50% higher than those of people who are not college-educated. But does that represent value added from college? That is, are those differences due to the innate differences of the people who attend college versus don't attend college? Or is it something that if you had two identical people and sent one of them to college and one of them not to college, would the difference in those two identical people, would those earnings be as large as the average differences? And I'll tell you right away, the answer to that one is no. That two identical people, one going to college, one not going to college, will have a much smaller difference in earnings than the sort of the average person who attends college and the average person who does not attend college, because they are not two identical people. An example that economists have looked at is the value of attending an Ivy League university, a prestige university, versus a state school. And they find that for people admitted to identical sets of colleges, those who choose to attend the prestige schools do no better in terms of earnings than those who choose to attend less prestigious schools. So by that measure, the value added of the prestigious schools is not high, because if you once you control for the innate characteristics of the students who attend, it turns out that there's no additional value from the prestige universities. And that's an interesting and provocative finding. But this issue of measuring value added, it's just pervasive. If you look at differences in performance of different public schools or private schools, or just the second the elementary through high school, how do people what do people think of as a good school? They say, well, let's look at the SAT scores of the students coming out of school X and compare them with SAT scores of students coming out of school Y. Well, is that a measure of value added, or is that a measure of the caliber of the students going in? And that's a constant issue, because a lot of times when school officials try to explain divergent performance, they will fall back on, well, it's the innate characteristics of the student, and yet the school officials are supposed to be focusing on adding value. This issue of how much of the outcome for the school reflect just the innate ability of the students going into the school, and how much of it represents the actual value added of the school itself, is an important one throughout the economics of education, and it's one that we don't that we have difficulty measuring. Another issue in economics of education is that it combines investment and consumption. You can think of it as investment, and we use the term human capital. With physical capital, you pay a big upfront cost for a machine, and the machine gives services for several years. The machine helps produce output for several years, and so you can, as we talked about earlier in the class, you can talk about the rental value of that machine, what its earnings are. Similarly, you can think of education as an investment, where you spend money up front. You also pay an opportunity cost, that is, when you could be earning money instead of spending time in class. So you make an investment, and then over time you get a return on that investment if you get higher earnings. And again, you have to distinguish between value added and just the fact that some people would have earned more anyway. So education has this human capital component that you are building up. You're making an investment, and then over time you're going to earn a return on that investment. But also, education has a consumption value. That's when Fogel talks about lifelong learning to achieve spiritual insights, or just learn more about the world. He's really talking about education as a consumption value. And that isn't just true for lifelong learning, it also is true at college age. One of the essays in my book, and I think I've assigned it for this unit, is called "The World's Nicest Holding Pen." It discusses some of the things about college that make it consumption value. And if you look at something like the Patriot Center, its main purpose isn't really to provide education, but it makes George Mason a more fun place to go to school. So there's a lot, and this is pervasive. I mean, because I can see such a strong difference between when I went to college and today, just in terms of like the quality of meals that get served, or the quality of dorm life, or the fancy fitness centers that are in many colleges today. Clearly, there's a higher consumption value to college education today than there was when I was going to school. Another characteristic of education that's interesting from an economic point of view is something that I call a segregation equilibrium. That is, we notice that parents seem to be willing to pay very high prices for colleges or for housing in neighborhoods that have reputations for good schools. So, you know, people who live in Potomac in Maryland or Fairfax County in Virginia, and they'll move into neighborhoods where the high schools have the best reputations, and the price of housing in those neighborhoods gets higher and higher. Similarly, it seems like the tuition at the most elite colleges just keeps getting higher and higher, and yet, you know, parents are willing to pay that. And one hypothesis about that is that the parents are actually paying for the ability to send their children to schools with other rich children. So if you're rich and you want your children to go to school with other rich children, all you have to do is move to an expensive neighborhood or send your children to an expensive college. And at that point, you don't really, in some sense, you're happy to see either high-priced housing, in the case of the elementary schools and high schools, or you're happy to see a high-tuition college, because you know that those high prices are going to drive away poor people. And if what you want is your children to go to schools with other rich children, then you actually prefer those kind of high prices. And that's sort of a disturbing possibility to consider, this idea of the segregation equilibrium, that people will pay high prices in order to have their children be among other rich children and away from poor children. It's something to be concerned about, I think, in the way education could evolve, or maybe perhaps the way it has evolved. Another characteristic of education that's notable from an economic point of view is that entry and exit are rare. In most other industries, you see new firms coming up, old firms disappearing. We just saw, what was it, Sears and Kmart merging. So one of those old firms could, you know, you could even think of it as Sears, one of the oldest retailers going out of business. And you know, that sort of thing happens all the time in most industries. You know, companies go out of business, companies get into business. But in education, that's actually very rare. It's very rare to see a college go out of business, and it's very rare to see a new college get started. It's very rare to see public schools, any public school, be shut down. And it's fairly rare for new schools to be started. And that's peculiar, and from an economic point of view, that's very disturbing, actually, because one of the main ways that economies learn, remember the title of my book, Learning Economics, one of the main ways they learn is through entry and exit. So, you know, one of the ways that productivity increases, that output per worker increases, and that our standard of living increases is that new ideas succeed and old unproductive ideas fail. And the fact that we see very little entry and exit in the education field suggests that that kind of improvement, that mechanism of improvement, is being shut down. And that's, to me, a source of concern. And it raises the question of what are the factors that might cause entry and exit to be rare in the education industry. And one factor is regulatory, that is, you know, the government says this is an accredited school. Versus what's not an accredited school, and it's difficult to become an accredited school. So that makes it difficult to enter the industry. And it also means that any school that already is accredited is unlikely to exit because having that accreditation is something that's valuable. Another thing that's going on is that brands have very high value. Think of colleges and universities. The Harvard brand has just been strong for, literally centuries. So certain brand names have ongoing value. And that could be, go back to this issue that there's difficulty in measuring value added. Just as economists have a hard time being able to tell how much a difference, real difference, a college or even a high school is making, parents have difficulty too, and so they maybe go for the comfort of known brand names. If you can't directly measure what a school is accomplishing, you just say, well, it's Harvard, it must be good. And so the and that kind of brand name value might also account for the rarity of entry and exit. There's not a whole lot of churn or turmoil in the education industry because people choose schools based on brand. Sort of, if people chose that school in the past, it has a valuable reputation, and so people continue to choose it, and the reputation just becomes self-reinforcing. And there's no way for a new entrant to come in and establish a better reputation. And finally, we have an economic issue of what is public good versus private benefits. In economics, there's a formal definition of public good. It isn't just anything that's good for the public. A public good is something that the private individual will not pay for because they can get the benefit of it without paying for it. The classic example would be police protection or national defense. If you as an individual decided you didn't want to contribute anything to to police protection or national defense, if it's nonetheless being provided as part of an overall service, you would get the benefit anyway. And the reason that economists call those things public goods is that if it were left to each individual would say, well, let somebody else pay for the police force. I'll benefit, but I can benefit without paying for it. And so in the absence of taxes and government, there wouldn't be a police force, there wouldn't be national defense. And so that's a sense in which technically they're public goods. That is, you need to have to compel everyone to provide for them. Otherwise, they won't be provided for because it's in each individual's interest to be what's called a free rider, to try to obtain the good without paying for it. Whereas with private goods like a hamburger, just the fact that you buy a hamburger doesn't enable me to consume a hamburger, but the fact that you might pay for national defense might mean that I would not have to. So a public good is something where you could free ride, where you can get the benefit without necessarily having to pay for it. A private good, you get the benefit only if you pay for it. So where does education fit in on this? Do you get the benefit of education only if you pay for it? Well, certainly for your own education, that's true. But there's, to some extent, people benefit from having a more educated society. I benefit from your being educated. But so the question is how much beyond the private benefit is there a public benefit? That is, how much more than what you're willing to pay to be educated should I be willing to pay to have you be educated? How much beyond the benefit that you get from your education is a benefit that society gets from you being educated? My guess is it's not 100% of the benefits of education. That is, I don't get anywhere near 100% of the benefits of your education. It's probably a much smaller percentage. So what that would argue for is that taxpayer funding shouldn't pay for 100% of people's education because people are getting their own private benefits. They should pay for most of it, maybe not quite all of their education, but they should pay for most of it with perhaps a little bit of subsidy from the government thrown in to account for the fact that in addition to the private benefits that you get, there are some social benefits to education. But this issue of public good versus private benefits generates a lot of confusion because sometimes people talk as if all of the benefits of education are public benefits as opposed to private benefits, and yet economists probably would argue that the majority of the benefits of education are private benefits rather than public benefits. So overall, the picture that I want to convey with all these things is that there are actually a lot of reasons to be skeptical of the traditional veneration of public support for education. We start out with the difficulty of measuring value added. What if it's the case that that the supposed best schools really don't add much more value? They're just taking in the better students. There's the issue of education as consumption. To some extent, people are being educated because they enjoy the overall education experience. And certainly, students, when they choose colleges, a big factor in their choice is sort of how much they're going to enjoy that particular school. The issue of rare entry and exit and regulatory factors and branding suggests that it is hard to know whether it's the best schools that are surviving and that are attracting the best students, or whether it's just a matter of reputations being self-reinforcing and people not being able to measure value added. And so they just keep attending the same schools based on their past reputations. And then finally, the issue of public goods versus private benefits raises the question of, are we attributing a huge public benefit to something that actually is mostly private benefits? So overall, when you put this all together, the difficulty of measuring value added, the amount of consumption value, the reputations, and so on, I think there's room for a lot of question about how much value, how much public value, value that you would want to have taxpayers subsidize, how much public value schools provide compared to the value that we tend to impute to schools and to the overall cost of schools. Okay, so that's kind of the overview, and in the next two talks, I'll talk first about sort of primary education, through high school, and then I'll talk about college education.